Mills is a journalist who I would be excited to have on the show based on his CV alone. He spent 5 years on the trailblazing Radiolab team, starting in 2012.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Three, two, one. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And today on Radiolab, blame.
All right. So.
Tell me your name again.
Then he went to work for the New York Times, where he was on the team that created The Daily.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. In the time since the 2016...
The Daily is, of course, a juggernaut success that hasn't only changed podcasting forever, it proved that there is a way for a newspaper to reach online audiences that don't even read newspapers without sacrificing any of the depth of written reporting and while making millions and millions of dollars. It's hard to overstate how important that is, given where things are at with the newspaper industry writ large. His podcasting work for the New York Times won a Peabody Award, and it got a Pulitzer Prize citation. And based on all of that, I'd be thrilled to have him on the show to talk about his work. But that is not why he's on the show today. You see, the New York Times had to give back that Peabody. And the Pulitzer Prize board stripped Andy Mills and his colleagues of their recognition after another hit podcast that he co-created, Caliphate, fell apart.
It's a question most journalists have had to ask themselves at one time or another. What if this great story I'm chasing is too good to be true?
Was an award-winning podcast by the New York Times all just a hoax?
The central premise of this podcast was interviewing this guy who had served as an ISIS fighter in Canada and has not gone to jail. That guy, though, however, was just charged by Canadian authorities with fabricating ever going to Syria, meaning that the entire premise of the podcast itself, I don't want to say fake, but it's a lie.
You might remember the media scandal dubbed Caliphale. We did a whole episode on it back in 2021. Caliphate was hosted by star New York Times reporter Rukmini Kalamaki, who co-created it with Andy Mills, who produced it. And it told the story of ISIS, the Islamic State. They centered their narrative on the story of a Canadian, Shiroz Chowdhury, a guy who said that he had traveled to Syria to join ISIS, where he actually performed executions on their behalf. But in 2020, after the Caliphate podcast was published, the RCMP charged Chowdhury with hoax terrorist activity. They claimed that he'd made the whole thing up, and Chowdhury later admitted in court to fabricating his story, and the Crown dropped the charges. When we first talked about Caliphate on Canada Land, we examined how a news organization as respected as the New York Times could make a mistake of that scale. And we took a close look at what the incident could tell us about foreign conflict reporting and about the use of cinematic podcast narratives as a storytelling format. But we didn't end our coverage there, because there was more to that story. In the fallout of the Caliphale, Andy Mills became a target of harsh online criticism. And who was this guy anyhow? Stories emerged of his problematic behavior at work when he was on the Radiolab team. He was known for asking out his female colleagues. He gave one of them a back rub at a work meeting. And, the worst of it, at an after-work social event, he poured a drink on a female colleague's head. This was all years in his past, and Andy Mills had admitted to it all, apologized, taken training, been punished for it, and passed over for promotion. His new bosses at the New York Times knew about it, and initially, they supported him. But as the pressure grew and grew, ultimately, they offered him a generous severance package to leave his dream job at the New York Times. Now, when we covered that part of the story, we reached out to Andy Mills with an interview request, but he did not accept. And to be perfectly honest, that was the last time I thought about Andy Mills. Until earlier this year, when he surprised me with an email. He reached out to me, not in anger or to settle an old score, but because he believed that I was in the, quote, midst of a public shaming myself. As you may remember, I have been facing a torrent of trolls since I began speaking up about the social and political fallout in Canada from the October 7th attacks in Israel. Mills wrote to me, quote, I don't believe you should feel ashamed one bit for standing up against hate crimes and vandalism, end quote. He offered me his friendship in case I needed to talk to somebody who might be able to relate to what I was going through. I took the opportunity to start chatting with him about other stuff. I mean, this was really a rare opportunity, really interesting to be able to have a civil conversation with somebody who I have covered negatively in the past. Most of the time, the only contact that you're going to have is a letter from their lawyer or maybe a punch in the jaw if you happen to bump into them in public. So we started chatting about journalism and ethics and all sorts of things. And at a certain point, I just asked him, can we record this conversation? He said yes. And the one thing we both agreed this episode should not be is a conversation about so-called cancel culture and our respective experiences facing criticism and abuse online. As you will hear, we both broke that rule in the first few minutes. Wait for it. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Jesse.
This is a really unique conversation in that it's not every day that I have just a conversation with somebody who had been the subject of our, you know, podcast, of our journalism in the past.
Right. And not exactly a praiseworthy story as well.
Well, that's it. When somebody is the subject of critical coverage, of course we reach out and say, we'd like to get your side of this. And then we understand that sometimes, for whatever reason, people choose not to. And if they choose not to, that's usually it. To actually talk about it like a couple years later was rare.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, I reached out to you because I saw that you were going through something online that not only have I been through a version of myself, but I'm interested in, had been interested in it before I went through it myself, and I remain interested in it today. And I sadly know from personal experience that it can be a really scary time, and not too infrequently, people, they have serious suicidal thoughts. And as much as I might have been frustrated by the coverage on Canada Land of Caliphate in my own situation, I just wanted you to know that, like, most people don't think that way, and you aren't the worst things that people say about you on the internet. And I just wanted to make sure that you were around friends and that you had some support.
To bring our listener up to speed with where we were at with it, I accept certain principles about the work that we do. And I believe even in some of the cliches that get bandied about a lot, that our job is to afflict the comfortable. Comfort the afflicted is maybe the more important part. But you know, yeah, I'm in the job of afflicting people, which is like a weird thing to be in the business of, like, yes, I'm trying to afflict the right people for the right reasons, but I accept that this work harms people. Mm. So when I find myself on the receiving end of criticism and I am being afflicted, I try not to feel too sorry for myself and just maybe even learn from this that this is something that I've put other people through. But where we were at in our conversation was a conversation about maybe looking again at that concept. Like, is it possible to do journalism that doesn't afflict someone, that does not harm?
What do you mean when you say harm someone? How do you define that?
Well, in the general dictionary sense, I think that, you know, it's sort of become jargonified, but synonymous with affliction. There's no point to me in doing journalism if it doesn't have some kind of impact, if it doesn't matter or have the power to change things. So when I say harm, that's what I mean, is like,
okay,
somebody's been getting away with something, and our job is to figure it out and tell the world about it.
There is at the heart of what we do as journalists a power to change things. And I think that we want to be on the side of changing things for the better and not the worse. But I think that maybe where we start to diverge is this idea, and I've heard it a lot, that what social media did was it kind of democratized this power of journalism. Part of that's true, but I think that it fails to reckon with some of the negative changes that have taken place in the world of journalism. And I think the shortest way to sum that up would be to say, both on social media and too often in our world of journalism, there is a really big difference between publishing an accusation and investigating an accusation. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and it's so easy to publish.
I'm not trying to take a stance against all of the contemporary journalism or all of the social media forces. I definitely see the situation as nuanced, but I think that that's a part of this disagreement you and I have about whether or not harm is an essential or even important element to what we do, and if it, in fact, is a part of the source of the power that we have.
So do we disagree? You know, I've done reporting on victims of sexual assault, and, you know, there's a very robust conversation in Canada about best practices for reporting on Indigenous communities that have been through terrible things, and to not be extractive. The word harm does come up. It's like there's a way to do this without doing harm. And I always push back a little bit on this solutions thing and on this like do no harm thing. Like if those are the rules, I don't know how you could ever publish an important story. Like is that something we disagree about?
When I'm hearing the word harm in the kind of New York progressive journalism world, I'm actually often hearing it in a way that feels like I have a bigger disagreement with that crowd than I do with you, which is this idea that we should do no harm, and they mean we should pay our sources when we talk to them, which is against most of the basic principles of journalism I believe in, or that even by going to tell their stories that we're somehow harming them. That being said, activist journalism has a long tradition and is fine. It's just not the kind that I seek to do, and it's not the kind that I think can be most impactful. So maybe because you've done a good job of showing me how you got here, maybe I could tell you a little bit more of how I've gotten to where I am, and that can help make some sense of this. So I grew up in a small town, and like many small towns in America, very religious, and I had profound religious experiences that led me to believe that the most important thing in this world was spreading the message of Jesus Christ. And so I went to a Christian college to become a minister. But while I was there, I learned that things were a lot more complicated than I had been led to believe in my studying of theology and church history over the first few years I was there. It really led me to be less interested in an occupation where I would try to convince people to believe exactly what I believed, and more interested in trying to understand why anyone believes anything and how those beliefs inspire them to do things in this world. And that's ultimately what led me to becoming a journalist. And it wasn't an easy jump from one to the other. My first job was in South Sudan. I was there in 2007 and 2008 as they were trying to form a country and dealing with this 20-plus year-long civil war that they had just survived, and did a lot of reporting there about victims of sexual assault, sexual violence, people who had been raped, people had been murdered, whole groups of people who had been slaughtered. It was a humbling and powerful experience to be a professional listener and to professionally be curious about our fellow man's experience in a different part of the world and how those experiences shaped them, shaped their beliefs, shaped their desires, right? But it was also there that I started to learn about this other aspect of journalism that's important, because I saw what it looked like for a country to not have any journalism at all. Because I was traveling a lot throughout the country, I got to interview all kinds of people in all kinds of different situations, and I interviewed a lot of teachers. And what I heard continually from these teachers was that they hadn't been paid in months. And one day I pulled into this small village. They had a little tent set up. They were selling beer underneath the tent. And there was this guy there who was dressed nicer than everybody else, who was buying drinks for people, and people were patting him on the back. And I asked, who's this guy? And I learned, oh, this is the Secretary of Education. This is the Minister of Education. And I was like, is this the guy that hasn't been paying anyone their earnings? And he's like, yeah. And here he is dressed in a nice suit. He had a nice motorcycle. He was buying everyone drinks. And I thought, wow, in my country, I could expose this person. I could take some photos. I could interview the people. I could show the populace that this person who's supposed to be doing their job and isn't is here instead getting drunk with a bunch of people. And seeing like the different kinds of power that journalism had, both when it was present and when it wasn't, has definitely shaped the way that I've been a journalist ever since. I guess I wouldn't say that when you expose an injustice, like the one that I saw with this education minister in Sudan, I would make sure, I wouldn't try and say he's some kind of evil guy. Because it's not a good story if it's just, look at this guy, he sucks. The more you try and make this education minister in Sudan into these others, into these like abominable monsters people, the more that I think you're losing the power that the story really possesses at the heart of it. And I think that that's where maybe you and I have a difference of approach and a difference in our philosophy that we bring to the job.
I actually feel like we're just at a level of semantics here because, of course, if you were in a position to write about that that guy who's abusing his role in Sudan, he would consider himself harmed and would hopefully suffer consequences. I think what we're actually talking about here is that the kind of complicated stories that we seek to tell that might involve somebody losing some stature or facing consequences or told responsibly, that whole structure, which was easier to preserve previously, has now been reduced to binary dynamics of let's figure out who the bad people are.
I think that maybe this is a good place for us to try and weave together the two strains of this conversation because I think they're connected. You have here in both journalism and in the public shaming economy a sense of, I think, tribalism over something like values or even something like profit. It simplifies it a little bit too much, but I think that the two strongest forces behind the public shaming on the internet phenomenon, one of them is kind of a good thing, which is the thirst for a more just world at a time when people don't feel like they have enough power to make that just world. And you know what? They can join in on this online shaming, join the dog pile, and it feels like, okay, maybe we can leave the world a little bit better than how we found it. Even if it's just taking this person's job or getting this person to issue some kind of apology, like maybe we're doing our part. But I think the other one is the scarier one, which is the tribalism, that we're very social creatures down deep, and we want to be liked. We want to belong. Especially right now when we don't have as much religious affiliation, we don't have the civic affiliations and civic engagement, our tribes, whether they're about politics or something harder to define, they're meaning more and more to us. Mm-hmm. And this happens in the world of journalism too. I think some of the best reporters and best storytellers out there are being muzzled by a fear of being seen as too generous to the quote-unquote other side. I will say that when you're shaming somebody, especially in a public setting, you should make sure that you're shaming them for things they actually did or for beliefs they actually hold. And that is something that is very rare. And that's something that journalism could do a good job of correcting for.
Yeah.
I tried to do this with the J.K. Rowling documentary that I made. Why do you like Harry Potter?
I had not such a great childhood.
Teaches, you know, the importance of friendships.
What do you think of J.K. Rowling?
So there's a lot of controversy with that one.
I'm Megan Phelps Roper, and these are the Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling.
I was not trying to say J.K. Rowling was right or she was wrong. What I was trying to do is show J.K. Rowling's views in the context of her life, why in the world she would say such a thing, why this of all issues, why does she think this is important, what are the stakes for her, and then talk to her critics about why they are not just upset, but they feel so hurt, and then go to her and get her to respond to her critics. And both of them, I push them both to be in the best faith possible, right? Like, because there's nothing wrong with arguing with J.K. Rowling's views. In fact, we have to argue with J.K. Rowling's views. And fill in whoever you want for J.K. Rowling, right? That's what makes a robust, open society. The trouble is when we start to shame, police, punish people for views that they don't hold, for things they haven't done because of that tribal instinct that I was talking about. And I do think that you have been guilty of that in your work. And I think that I'm hoping that your own experience with being at the center of it will cause you to second guess that notion next time, to make sure before highlighting some kind of public shaming that your facts are correct, that this is something the person has done, or this is a view that this person holds. And it's not just the least charitable possible interpretation of their actions or views because it feeds into some larger tribal instinct. And I say that all while at the same time saying, I'm not interested in telling a story called, I got canceled, I was so wronged, let me correct the story. I'm not trying to publish that story, I'm not interested in it. I'm just interested in human nature. Even when that story catches me up in it, I try to lead with curiosity to say, huh, what's happening, why? What's at the root of this? And that's me trying to stick to those ideals over becoming an ideologue and pushed into maybe becoming some kind of reactionary.
Well, let me react, because I want to engage with the ideas there, but I'm feeling a little bit called out now, and what
called in, Jesse, called in.
The first thing before we got to any of this conversation, when I first heard from you, when I hear from a source who we've covered in the past, especially critically, my first question to you is, did we get anything wrong? Years ago, when we reached out to you, you didn't write us back. But that there's no statute of limitations on an error. If we got something wrong, I want to correct it now.
I think you and I both agreed that we're not interested in relitigating a public shaming event from years ago.
Me neither, but then you said that we're guilty of maybe piling on. So
I don't think that it's unique to me, but I mean, I think if you want to look at mine as a case study, the framing of your guest who came on at the end of the episode, who specifically spoke about me, was that she was bringing up reasonable concerns about workplace behavior that was unprofessional and unwelcome. And that when she alerted Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily, to this on Twitter, this powerful media person blocked her, which is just a sign of people in media being unwilling to reckon with bad behavior. And that's just not what happened. I mean, your guest, for many days, was making accusations that I was a sexual predator and guilty of serious crimes.
Not on our show. We did not publish those accusations.
No, and I appreciate that. But after not getting much traction saying those things on her own Twitter feed, she began to, I don't know what you call it on Twitter when you write a tweet underneath someone's tweet, but she began to go onto Michael Barbaro's Twitter account, and whenever he would post the next day's daily episode, would use that platform to say that I was a sexual predator, and that because Michael Barbaro and the New York Times would not distance themselves from me, that we should equate the New York Times with support for sexual predation. Now, once again, I'm not saying it was the right thing to do for Michael to block her, but I am saying that that context was important, and the fact that I'm not a sexual predator and that no one has ever even accused me, no victim of my predation has ever come forward. That's important, but it wasn't important to you, and it wasn't important to those who participated in the public shaming. And I'm not here to now shame you for how you did the shame. I'm saying that that's a microcosm of something bigger that's going on.
I wouldn't know what to correct if we were to correct that story. The context that you're giving me now would have definitely made that a better story, and we tried to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, and I'm not asking to run a correction. This isn't about me and my story. This is about you've now been in these shoes, and this is just me saying I hope going forward that it will shape your coverage of things like this and that you'll do your best to make sure that you're remembering that there's a difference between publishing an accusation and investigating it.
I don't think it would have been possible for us to tell the story as media reporters of what was going on, this major media story about what was happening with Caliphate, without also talking about what had happened to you. How do we tell that story of what's going on without talking about what's going on with Andy Mills? And in telling the story of Andy Mills, we don't have the power to say, well, this is actually an unfair bundling of issues, because it's reality at this point. All we can do is reach out to you for that context so that we're not only talking to the person who is accusing you. So we do the best we can with the information that we're able to investigate it and report.
Let me just say, I you did reach out to me, and because I was working at the New York Times and their PR people's belief was that the less we said about all this, the quicker it would go away, a belief that never came true. I didn't speak to you, and I wish I would have. And I do think that if I had spoken to you, you could have gotten something better for your story. And so I only have myself to blame for that piece.
This happens to me a lot because I report on journalists.
But let me tell you why I think it happens in part.
Okay.
This gets to something bigger than me and you, which I think is the important part, is that there's no incentive for giving the context of a story like this. It would not have been hard to look at what people were saying on Twitter in my case, and it wouldn't be hard to look at what people were saying on Twitter in your case and quickly see that through the game of Twitter telephone, accusations were being accelerated, motives were being assumed, and a frenzy to see some sort of action was coming about.
Mm-hmm.
And even just mentioning that is a powerful thing.
Can I ask you this? At some level, do you have to agree to be canceled? You were targeted, but so was Rukmini. And I don't know whether or not they offered her money to leave, but she still works at the New York Times.
Oh, she's, yeah, no, her job was never at risk, no.
The Times PR people told you not to stand up for yourself and provide this context when me and I have to imagine a lot of other people asked you for comment.
Correct.
Do you wish that you had? When they told you that your journalism on Caliphate was airtight and that they knew about your prior newsroom right. stuff and they didn't have any problem with you, but they'd like you to leave because it's just gotten too hot, did you agree to be canceled?
I think yes and no. I mean, once again, without relitigating the past too specifically, and trying to think about the broader world of journalism, I will just say, yes, I wish that I had spoken to you and to other reporters. But I'll also admit that I didn't exactly know what to say. It was hard to find words in that emotional place because I was trying to live out my value of being gracious and listening to people and fighting the urge to be defensive, while at the same time wanting to say, yes, I behaved in some very unprofessional ways. I did some things clearly regrettable, and I'm sorry. But also, I'm not a criminal. I didn't commit crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And this has gotten to be less about me and more about this other interesting phenomena. And that wasn't a story that anyone I think was interested in publishing. And those were words that were really hard to find then. I mean, they're still hard to find now.
I'm interested in this story because I'm interested in taking a closer look at how people have been depersoned. And I'm interested in the phenomenon that you're describing, in which I think we've created a whole lexicon of jargon to remove people's humanity. There's so many words that we use now that the effect of them is to shut people up, whether you're that's just both sidesing or that's just mansplaining or like there's a whole lexicon that if you say that word, what it means is we don't have to have a conversation. And I'm sure I've been guilty. I know I've been guilty of it even in not wanting to listen. When I first saw your show, I didn't know it was your show, The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. I'm like, well, right off the bat, I'm not interested in this. This is like that she's been put under a witch trial. Like, that tells me everything I need to know about this from the start.
Yeah, well, it was a provocative title, and I sometimes I regret it.
Well, for me, it placed it in.